about unions. Unions is really not so much a sugya in Bava Metzia, but it's one of the outer topics, certainly very much neged poelim, but also emerges from a lot of what we've been talking about. And then we'll segue from there to topics in Daf Pei Gimel. In Daf Pei Gimel, one of the main things you have there is the minig, establishing what happens. So that's very relevant to issues of severance and the like, which is one of our major things on our agenda. And there's also the Gemara there about Lefnim Mishor Sadin, that famous Gemara that we quote off in that context. So we'll try to get at least those topics done before we run out of time. But in terms of unions, so the topic of unions is an interesting one. There are a number of essays written about it, and what we'll find, and it's a little bit of a chaval that we don't have access to sorry right now, but I'll just have to take my word for it, but the refrain of Pol Yochel Achzer V'Chatzi Ayom keeps coming back. That topic, that sugya that we've been referencing the past few weeks, that we spent some time at length during the semester talking about, it keeps rearing its head. It keeps having an impact on all the issues of Pol. So it's relevant when we talk about unions as well, because we have to figure out the idea of a union means that the workers have some rights, or it presumes that workers have some rights if they should get together and decide what they're going to do and what they're not going to do. So what exactly are the rights of a worker when he decides he wants to change his working conditions? So when we talked about Pol Yochel Achzer V'Chatzi Hayom, so we saw that most of the poskim understood, it seems, that that is a reference only to his right to not be an eved. So therefore, he has the right to stop working. He has the right to avoid eved status. But he doesn't have the right to leverage that. So, for example, Tor quotes from the Ri, and this is a major issue that we'll come back to, that he doesn't have the right to say that he's going to quit unless he gets paid more. He just has the right to quit. So if he wants to quit, he can quit. But if he says, "Quit, I'm going to quit if you don't pay me more," so then that's not something he can do. He can't leverage this into better working conditions. It's only the up or down question of whether he's going to be an eved or not. Now that's a major point we'll come back to. But it's also interesting to note that Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, in his Tshuvos and his Minchas Shlomo, in Siman Pei Zayin, takes it a step further and says that even if you want to say that he could use this as a negotiating ploy, he could use this to say, "I want more money." He, however, still is limited in that he can't use this to say, "You can't hire anybody else." If the boss is going to say, "I'll take somebody else instead of you because you're pulling out to get more money," so then the worker would indeed have no leverage over such a decision from the boss. So it seems like, for the most part, the worker doesn't really have inherent rights in the sense of getting what he wants. We've been discussing throughout what rights he has in terms of limitations of the boss's right to impose avdus on him. So this is the big one, that he can't be stopped from quitting. And we discussed also how he can't give him avodas aved, avodas parach, demeaning work, and the like. So there are some inherent limitations. We discussed Rabbi Levine's chiddush. It's also we take note of the fact that we've been quoting Rabbi Aaron Levine, Zechon Levracha. So this past week, his Rebbetzin passed away. His Rebbetzin was a big part of his work in bringing those posthumously published works to print. So it's important to take note of this chus that they have in this topic. So we mentioned his chiddush vis-a-vis the ability to make phone calls and the like. So there are certain inherent rights that it seems to be the Poel has. But in order to get what he wants through bargaining and through striking, so it's not so clear if he has those rights as an individual. However, what about not as an individual, but as a group? What about as part of a union? Is there such a thing? So that's an interesting question to explore. And to explore that question, we'll first mention that there is an important article on this topic, which I'll make reference to in the next few minutes, before moving on to other writings about this topic. But there is an important article on this topic written by my good friend and colleague, Rabbi Danny Rapp, wrote an article about the topic of unionization, which was published in a volume which was actually edited by Rabbi Levine, by the Oxford Handbook of Judaism and Economics. So in that work, there's an essay by Rabbi Rapp where he talks about this question of unions. So some of what we'll say in the next few minutes is discussed in that article. So what exactly is, what would you think the concept would be of a union? What's the halachic construct of a union? The Gemara in Maseches Sukkah does make reference to the idea of guilds. We know that in general there is a benefit that's recognized if you have a professional organization. You have a group of people who are all engaged in the same profession. So if they get together, so there's what they can gain from that. They can gain trade secrets, and they can gain mutual support, and they can share whatever they have learned in terms of how to best perform what they do. So that's something that the Gemara seems to make reference to, this idea that people who are in a certain profession tend to stick together for such reasons and such values. But there's also more. There is a Tosefta, which the Gemara quotes a little bit of in Bava Kamma, that the workers of each group have the ability, should they choose, to make policies. They can decide when we're going to work and when we're not going to work, how we're going to work and how we're not going to work. In other words, if there are, part of the whole idea of a union is that there are certain acts, or there are certain impositions that the workers don't want placed upon them. So therefore, if they all agree, they're not going to put up with it, so then they have this collective power. If some of them are willing to work under those conditions and some aren't, then the ones who are willing to work under those conditions will get all the jobs, and the ones who aren't will then just have to lose all their work. So because the workers want to have certain benefits, and they don't want to lose their jobs to people who don't want those benefits or who aren't going to insist on those benefits, so then the union makes it a policy that all the workers who either have to join the union, or at least if they want to benefit from the union, they'll join the union, and then they'll all get the collective bargaining, they'll all get these policies together. So that idea is reflected in this Tosefta, where it talks about people in different professions insisting on certain rules, making certain policies, which seem to be designed to allow the workers to get the conditions that they want and not have other workers in the same field accept less than that. So what's the basis of that authority? If that's what the Tosefta and the Gemara make reference to, so where does this power come from? Anyone want to take a stab at it? Where would the Billy, what's that based on? Is that a din in the Torah? Is that some kind of a mutual understanding? How would that work? Why would there be such a thing that workers can get together and make rules that could be binding on other workers in the same profession? I want to try to suggest a model. Why should, if I decide I don't want to do something, how does that affect you? So many of the Rishonim suggest that this is essentially comparable to an idea the Gemara talks about in the beginning of Bava Basra, and indeed there are Gemaras there which connect to this point, the Gemara in Daf Ches and Daf Tes in Bava Basra, where the Gemara talks about Bnei Ha'ir. Anybody ever learned the first parak of Bava Basra? So there the Gemara talks about certain, first the Mishnah talks about partners and about their obligations together, or neighbors and their obligations together. And the Gemara goes on the end of that first parak to talk about, you have a city, so what do people do to participate in the city? They pay taxes, and they all contribute to certain things the city needs, etc., etc., and that there is authority of people who run the city to make rules. We have this concept of government, basically. We have this concept that there are people in charge who can make up new laws that aren't necessarily there before, but are considered necessary by the people of that populace in order to have law and order, and in order to have not just that, but to have the effective needs of the city cared for and attended to by the populace as a whole. So maybe you could say that there is somewhat of a comparable structure when it comes to people in a certain field. They make up their own community, they make up their own entity, and therefore, just like people in a city, we're going to somehow have a government and they're going to set rules for what they're going to do and what they're not going to do. So too, and what they're going to allow and what they're not going to allow. So maybe workers have the same right. Okay, that's possible. And very much to the point, and it's Kedai to take a look at, so you should make reference to this Gemara, the Gemara in Bava Basra and Daf Tesamud Aleph. The Gemara talks about butchers who made an arrangement that on certain days they can shecht, and certain days they can't shecht. And one of them violated the arrangement. So the other one said that the part of the deal is that if you violate the arrangement, you're in trouble, so I'm going to destroy your work. I'm going to rip up the animal that you shechted. And he did that. And then the guy who had his work destroyed took him to Beis Din to have him made to pay for this damage that he did. And then the Gemara says that essentially the ruling was in favor of the victim. The one who got his property ripped up, it was he got restitution, which seems to imply that this policy was no good. This policy that the butchers made, that they're not going to allow work to be done outside their framework, seems to be it was not a valid policy, because when they imposed the penalty, they were made to pay. So then the Gemara ultimately concludes that no, that doesn't necessarily show us that, because in that case there was an Adam Chashev, there was a distinguished person in town who had the ability to override that rule. So the implication is that in the absence of an Adam Chashev, so then there would have been a logical rule. It would have been true that the butchers could have made such a deal amongst themselves that this is how we're going to allow work to be done. And they could have imposed penalties, and they could have taken one of the workers' property, basically, and destroyed it and said, this is what we do in order to impose our policies. So one thing to take note of is that there is a girsa issue. If you look in the Rishonim over there, the Gemara seems to say that there were two butchers who made a deal amongst themselves. And that's a little bit of a complicated idea to understand. Many don't have that word, too. They say that there was a group of butchers. The whole group together made a policy, which is a bigger chiddush. Okay, so once you have a group that makes a policy, and the idea that individuals could theoretically be put in the position of rebelling against that policy, so then there's what to talk about. But if you have two people who agree on something, so then whatever they agree on, that's what they agree on. Where do you get such a complicated scenario? The Chazon Ish has a comment over there that has a different issue, that if you have two people, and they're the only two people, and they make a deal together, then the concern is that maybe it's a monopoly, and maybe it's going to affect negatively the community, and therefore we have to worry about it from that perspective. But let's assume for a second you take out the word two. So all the butchers made a deal, and it sounds like if there was no Adam Chashev to override it, it would have been a binding deal. That's essentially something that sounds somewhat union-like. So how exactly does this operate? How exactly does this idea that the workers make a policy and it becomes binding, to what degree is this comparable to the deal of the townspeople, to the idea that people in a city can set their rules and those rules are binding, and to what degree is it different? So here it's interesting that when you have a policy that's made, again, this is something that's not already covered by Torah law, and it's not something that's a ritual matter, it's basically a social matter. So under those circumstances, let's say you have a policy which is new, it's kind of, might even call it arbitrary, right? Some people posit a policy and others might not like it. So if you have a policy which some people will like and some people won't like, so how do you decide whether or not the policy is going to take effect? Does it have to be unanimous? Or is it enough that you have rov? Is it enough that you have a majority deciding on the policy? So this was a major machlokas rishonim, that the Ritva assumes that the majority is enough, and Rabbeinu Tam, who's quoted in the Mordechai, says since there are people who lose and there's no inherent system that makes it obvious that they have the right to have this law, so therefore the unanimous consent of the populace is necessary. So a lot of the poskim assume, like the Ritva here, that when it comes to the rule of the townspeople, you can suffice with a majority decision. If a majority get together and decide this is a good policy for the city, so then that's going to be enough. However, it's interesting that when you compare this to the policy regarding the workers, you don't find the same conclusion in it, even according to the same people. That the Ramah paskins like the Ritva on this point, that the majority is enough, but both the Ritva and the Ramah say regarding the workers that they need to have a unanimous policy. So why should that be? Why should it be that there's a difference between workers and the town people making a decision? The town people, it's enough to have the majority, and the workers have to have unanimous. One point Rabbi Rapp raises in his article is you could suggest that the machlokas here has a little bit to do with how do you see this policy being made in general. This idea that individuals are getting together and making a policy, making rules, how should we look at that? And on the one hand, you could say that it's like a shutfus, that essentially it's basically a partnership. So therefore, whoever doesn't want to be a part of the partnership is essentially outside of it. And then they have the right to be outside. While those who say the other way will assume that it's basically like a din melech, that they have essentially governmental authority over everyone by virtue of their coming together, and that makes it authoritative. In general, there is a question, both in terms of general legal philosophy, and also a sugya like Dina de Malchus Adina, where the question comes up, what is the authority of Dina de Malchus Adina based on? So, you know, where does law come from? Where do you get the idea that anyone can impose the law on anyone else? What gives the government the right to impose the law on anyone else? So some understand that essentially it's a question of aggregate, that the people get together and they decide that the rights that they have amongst themselves, they recognize that in order to have an efficient society, they need to have a controlling body that's going to make the decisions, that's going to give these rights, and therefore that's going to follow that policy. So that could be what's going on here also. Or you could say that it's a shutfus, and whoever is out of it is out of it. So that's essentially a question that's relevant to the workers. That you say essentially you can be outside of the shutfus and not be subject to the rules, or do you say differently that the rules can be imposed on you even if you don't agree with such rules? So there is a fascinating analysis of this issue in Rabbi Rapp's article. Points out also that one of the differences, as Rishonim point out, the Rash points out, that one of the differences is between the townspeople and the tradesmen is that if you're going to say when it comes to a townspeople that everything has to be unanimous, so then you could have some nut in the middle of the town, not necessarily a nut, but just somebody who's very, very strong in his position. He could paralyze the whole city. They're not going to be able to make any legislation because a minority is going to object. But when it comes to the workers' guild, so again, you could theoretically have people who are just going to be not a part of the union, and they won't necessarily have to mess up the whole program. They won't necessarily have to interfere with the whole idea. So these are interesting questions. The assumption then seems to be that one way or another, it works out that at least with unanimous policies, you could have a union, and that union will have a bargaining power. That union will have power that will be able to create certain realities on their behalf, at least vis-a-vis themselves. You know, that they'll be able to at least assert their policies over other workers. It's a good question whether or not this means they'll have rights as far as their bosses are concerned. That's a separate question. That's something that we'll have to consider a little bit. So one question that could come up is, don't we have to worry that if the workers can set such policies, so then theoretically they could also do so to the detriment of the population, that they could set prices so high, or they could make conditions as such that, and this is in contemporary society, you have laws against this, that you could have a scenario essentially which is like a monopoly, where you could have collusion among the different parties and among the different producers of whatever product, that they're not going to allow others to provide merchandise at a reasonable price, and it's going to be a great detriment to society. So theoretically, the Gemara says that, for example, when it comes to prices, so we have a concept called onah, right, that we know that you're not allowed to charge more than a sixth more than the going rate. However, that's just referencing the going rate. So you can't have other people are selling it for this price and you're going to sell it for twice that price. But what if all the stores in the city are going to get together and decide that they're going to charge at a higher price? That'll become the going rate. It won't necessarily be onah, but it still will be a price-fixing situation where everybody is going to suffer for that reason. So theoretically, when the Gemara says you have an Adam Chashuv, if you have a prominent person in society who can overrule these policies, so then that protects society to a certain extent. But in the absence of that, so you need to have a Beis Din that's going to get involved and that's going to protect society if theoretically there is a policy that is against the interests of the population as a whole. And that's what the Gemara kind of alludes to in the context of prices. Then this comes up all the time, not so much in the halachic context, but it's always discussed that, for example, come Pesach time, so all the stores get together and decide the prices are going to be crazy high for people who need to buy products for Pesach, so then that's a great disadvantage to society. And it's not necessarily because the merchants have to set the price high, because it's not that their costs are so high, it's that they can take advantage of the fact that the population needs products for Pesach. So that's the kind of thing where ideally a Beis Din should get involved, and a Beis Din should say, we're not going to allow this. So the townspeople, theoretically, as represented by the Beis Din's power, the townspeople should be able to act as a control on the union forces, that the unions should have their right to operate for their own benefit, but if it gets to a point where they're doing so at the expense of the population as a whole is going to suffer from that type of agreement, so then the Beis Din has to get involved. And that's also, as we mentioned in the past, you have the idea of Dina de Malchus Adina is presumably also relevant, because again, we discussed a little bit a few weeks ago the whole question of what Dina de Malchus Adina means, practically speaking. But we do find the Shach's position that it's there to regulate anything that Halacha doesn't regulate for itself. The whole discussion against the Chazon Ish. And Rav Henkin has a famous tshuva where he talks about the rent control, things like that, and the question of whether or not Jews should be subject to the New York state laws of rent control, and there he assumes that these policies that are made to benefit all of society, and Jews are not autonomous, Jews are a part of that society, so they should also be subject to these rules, and presumably that's going to apply in the context of these unions as well. So those are some of the thoughts that Rabbi Rapp discusses. There is a sefer, you can download it on HebrewBooks.org, called Mishnas Poelim. It's a short sefer, you can read the whole thing. It's got a couple of simanim written by Rav Avraham Yehoshua Bick. It was published in 1947. And he talks about some of the issues of workers in general, the sugyos of Poelim and our Gemaras. And so he talks over there also about unions. And he takes it the given that unions are an acceptable model within halacha. And he also assumes, based on this Gemara in Bava Basra, the whole idea that we find that the workers could theoretically penalize each other for violating their policies, that that's an idea of halachic recognition of a union. He mentions that there was someone there from the Poel Mizrahi, he quotes, who had argued against unions, and made reference to a well-known Gemara Masachas Yuma and Daf Lamed Ches, where the Gemara talks about people who knew how to make the Ketores and knew how to make the Lechem Apanim, and they didn't want to share this with anyone. And so the Rabbanan ended up bringing in workers from outside to be able to do what they were doing that they wouldn't teach anyone else. So it sounds a little bit like union busting. Right? It sounds a little bit like going against the union rights of these workers who were claiming they wanted to have protection for their industry. So this was Gemara was cited as a proof that halacha does not recognize unions. So the author of the Mishnah's poem, he writes, he doesn't think that that's relevant. He says, for a couple of reasons. He says, first of all, that these people are not striking for better work conditions. They're striking to keep other people out of the field, which is not what a union is meant to do. That's not the whole purpose of a union. And also, it's going to mean that the lechem apanim is not going to be produced if they get their way. So that's also not what we would call a union, and that would mean to the detriment to the Beis HaMikdash. So he has there what's really a little bit of a pun. He says, the Gemara says, Ein Shvus BaMikdash, which normally means we don't have Din D'Rabbanan, we don't have Chazal making a gzeir in the Beis HaMikdash. So he writes, Ein Shvisa BaMikdash. There's no strike in the Beis HaMikdash. That would have too much of a consequence. But to say that this is a proof that you can't have unions in general, so that's not necessarily the case. And then he goes on to say there that the decision of the Chachamim in Eretz Yisrael, this is before the state he was writing, but there were Rabbanim and there were Torah scholars already living in the pre-state Israel, so that the policy they have taken there with the workers is that they do recognize the concept of unions. So he says, so therefore that gives it a status of Minig HaMedina. So if it's Minig HaMedina, he says, so that itself is going to be significant, that itself is going to override other things. And he also has an interesting application there, that he makes reference to the Ramban's famous comments on the Asisa Hayosher V'Hatov, which is a fascinating idea. So why would you assume necessarily that you can apply the Asisa Hayosher V'Hatov to the concept of unions? So he suggests that if you look at the language of the Ramban, he says, why does the Ramban say that the Torah tells us, V'yasisa yosher v'atov, you have to do that which is right and good? It's because the details of what it means to be right and decent are going to vary from time to time and place to place. So the Torah can't give very clear parameters that are going to apply everywhere in terms of what to do, but you have to be able to recognize within every setting what it means to be yashar and tov. So therefore, since we've seen in the modern era that we need unions in order to protect the basic rights of the workers, and that's not the kind of thing that the Torah could have laid out very specifically, because it's going to vary from society to society. So therefore he writes, that's within the rights of the workers to impose or to take advantage of, and that's his understanding that unions, and his assertion, his strong assertion, thinks are definitely covered by what the Torah is addressing in that context, which is a fascinating idea. And just mentioned for a few more minutes, he goes on in one of his later Simanim, and that's from the Mishnah's Poelim and Siman Dalet, talks about the idea of striking. So do we assume that a worker has the right to strike in order to better his working conditions? So that again goes back to the initial points that we started off with today, to what extent the workers have rights in that nature, what extent they have the right to take such a step. So we mentioned at the outset, and the topic we also talked about a little while ago, that even if we say Pol Yachal Achzav Achatzi Hayom, so that shouldn't seem to extend to this. It's interesting, he quotes Rav Kook in this essay as saying that workers have the right to strike in order to push things towards Besdin. Let's say, for example, if the employer is not treating them properly, so theoretically they should have the right to go to Besdin, and if a Besdin rules in their favor, they should have the right to have the policy of Besdin imposed. But what if that's not going to happen? What if the boss is not going to either go to Besdin in the first place or follow the psak of Besdin? So therefore, you'll need to strike in order to bring that about. So that's what he assumes you should be able to do. But then he goes on to say, also, the right exists because of Pol Yachal Achzer B'chatzi Hayom. There's that phrase again, keeps coming back again and again. It's clearly one of the most significant ideas that you find in this area of Paul. So what does that got to do with striking? It seems to be, we've been assuming till now, that the Paul Yochel Achzer does not really involve striking, involves his ability to leave. Like we said before, the Torah quotes from the Ri that the Paul cannot quit to leverage for a higher salary, he can only quit to quit. You mentioned that earlier today, you mentioned that in the past. So he notes a couple of points. First of all, there's a little bit of a machlokas we're showing whether or not that's true, so whether or not that's accepted, the halacha, there were some poskim who disagreed, and therefore, since it's a machlokas, it might be the right of the worker to say, Kimli, I follow that opinion that it is within my rights to do that, and that's one issue. But he also quotes from the Knesset Yechezkel, who says that this only means that if he's going to work for this boss one way or another, and he says, but I'll quit unless you pay me more, so then he doesn't have that right. But if he's theoretically willing to work for anyone, so he'll go to work for somebody else who will pay him more, so then he does have the right to quit, to go work for somebody else who will pay him more, which means also if the boss wants to keep him, so then the boss is going to be open to that type of idea. So that's one possible Pesach, even from this famous din of Paul Yochel Achzer B'Chatzi Hayom, to possibly address strikes as something that might be recognized within the basic rights of a poll. So he quotes from Chaim Hirschinson, I don't know if that's a familiar name to you or not. He's, there are many who are very fond of his writings, even though he's not necessarily as well known as others, but he's the author of the Tshuvas Malki B'Kodesh. You can find that on HebrewBooks.org as well. So he writes over there that you could argue against strikes based on a din we've discussed in the past, another limitation of Paul Yochel Achzer V'Chatzi Hayom, called Davar HaAvod. We know that even when an individual worker doesn't have the right to pull out of his job, if doing so is going to cause a monetary loss to the boss. So it would seem like that's the case here, right? If all those people are going to strike, they're not going to work, so then that's going to cause a loss to the... It's going to cause a loss to the boss, so you would think that that might be a limitation on his right to pull out. That may be a reason to say that Paul Yochel Achzer V'Chatzi Hayom shouldn't apply. So he assumes against this because he says that the existence of strikes has been already established in society as a minig, so it's a minig ha-medina, so to speak, so therefore that's going to counter this factor of Paul Yochel Achzer V'Chatzi Hayom. And therefore, kind of ironically, you find that the same sources actually end up supporting a strike, that there are those who say that the strike breakers are going to be in the category of a masig vul, or in the category of somebody who's basically encroaching upon the income of other people. And the Gemara has the concept of ani hamahafich b'charor, that if somebody has said, the Gemara talks about if you have fishermen who set out nets that they're going to catch fish in a certain area, and you come and you go after the same fish, so then that's a problem. That's considered to be a violation of the rights of the people who have set out to make an income in this area. So too, if you have people who their jobs are only available right now because they're on strike, so you're going to take their jobs as a strike buster, so he assumes that that's going to be in this category of ani hamahafich b'charara, that somebody who comes and who takes what another person has kind of staked out. The Gemara says nikra rasha, such a person is called a rasha. What exactly that means practically is an important question, but it's something bad. So it seems to be that you're basically encroaching on somebody else's welfare and somebody else's ability to make a living, so he thought that that was the category that was relevant to those who would try to undo a strike, which is a fascinating perspective. Clearly one could disagree, but he assumes, and again in his understanding as well, as we mentioned a few minutes ago, of the Ramban's Sisla Yashar V'Hatov, that these unions and strikes, these are mechanisms that have been set up by society in order to protect the rights of workers. So therefore, he thinks it's a straightforward application that this is going to be a reflection of what Vasisa Hayasha Bahatov calls for. Now, one can certainly disagree with this approach, and there are those who do. And there's a lot more to say about the question of the viability of strikes and the like. We're only mentioning a small part of it tonight as the outgrowth of the whole union question, which itself is an outgrowth of the whole Pol Yochel Achshav V'Chatzi Yom question. So just as much as it kind of connects from our sugya in a little bit of a expanding way, but without going into every single component that one could raise in terms of the whole strikes question, because also, if you accept the principle of strikes, so then you have other questions to ask. What about people who work in vital areas? What about policemen? What about doctors? What about teachers? What about people who, by striking, they're not only going to be affecting the rights of their boss, but they're also going to have an impact on society that may be too much to handle? And that's why, for example, in New York you have the Taylor Law, that there are certain professions that are not allowed to strike, regardless of their conditions. So that's a separate question. There's a lot to say about the whole issue of strikes in terms of some of the secondary and tertiary issues, but just in terms of the worker-employee relationship, so that's a major question to consider. So again, those are just some of the highlights. So what did we just, to quickly chazer, what did we call attention to tonight? So we mentioned the fact that, first of all, Shlomo Zalman's point that even if the worker could, against the Torah, even if the worker could pull out for the purposes of money, he can't necessarily stop the boss from replacing him. So the whole question of what rights do workers have? So it seems to be as individuals, their rights are limited, but as unions, it's possible there's more to it. We talked a little bit about the Gemara about guilds and about the Tosefta and the Gemara about how workers have the right to make policies within their fields, and the Gemara talks about imposing penalties for those policies, and the Gemara in Bava Basra seems to say that they couldn't impose penalties, they'd be liable, but then the conclusion of the Gemara is that's only because of the presence of an Adam Chashuv who overrode the policies, but otherwise apparently the policies are legitimate. We talked about the comparison between that and the policies made by townspeople as a whole, and the question of what is the model for those two power structures, and when do you need rove, when do you need unanimous, and talked a little bit about it by Rapp's article where he discusses all these points and talks about the issue of regulation and the absence of an Adam Chashuv. How do you make sure the policies are going to be consistent with the needs of society, and about Dina the Malchus Adina. And then we mentioned the Mishnah's Poelim, two tshuvas from the Mishnah's Poelim, one in support of unions in general. By the way, his understanding is that part of the way unions operate is that a rove is enough, that just the majority is enough to impose the desires of the union as a whole. It's a little bit differently than the way it comes out from Badab's presentation. And how he talks about the question of how does that emerge from the Gemara in Bava Basra, and how does that dealt with in terms of the Gemara in Yuma about the Ketores and the like. And then his question about striking, and the question about whether striking could be related to Pol Yochel Achshav V'Chatzi Yom, as Rav Kook asserted. So what about the tour's position that the Pol can't quit to get paid more? So the fact that, first of all, it's machlokas whether that's the halacha l'mais or not. And second of all, the question of, even if it is, the Knesset Yechezkel's position that that's only if you're going to stay at that job no matter what, but if you're going to move from one job to another, that may not be true. And then his basic assumption that this is not subject to a Dover HaAvod objection, like the Malkut HaKodesh said, because of the Minig, and his conclusion that this is, both of these ideas are a function of Hayashuv HaTov, meaning there's some people who would be very surprised to say that unions and striking is an issue of Hayashuv HaTov, but his point basically being that that pasuk tells us that the Torah doesn't necessarily formulate all the rules in a way that's going to apply all the time, but we understand that different societies are going to have different needs, and since contemporary society has decided that unions and strikes are legitimate, so therefore the halacha recognizes that as well. And then he goes on to assume those who would break a strike would be subject to the criticism of Hasagas Gvul and Ani Hamahafif B'Charar, they're basically encroaching upon the well-being and the parnasa of others, and are subject to such principles. And again, we emphasized that this is not the only way to see this issue, and the many who would disagree, and that it also becomes more complicated if you're talking about fields which are crucial to society functioning in a normal way. But these are just some of the points that emerge directly out of our Gemaras and out of related sugyas. Okay, so again, for tomorrow, I'd like to look to Daf Pei Gimel, and both the Gemara there about that which is the proper lifnei mishuras hadin for employers towards their employees, and the Gemara is about the Minig HaMedina, which will get us into issues of severance pay and firing and downsizing and the like. Some of you said, when I said before about scheduling, you said, who said he'd be here on Monday? How many of you said he'd be here on Monday?
Next week.
Okay, so maybe what we'll do is let's trade Thursday for Monday. We were originally planning on going to Thursday, but since Thursday seems to be a scheduling challenge, so let's assume we won't meet Thursday, we will meet Monday. Okay, so we'll do...